We're going to begin looking at Isaiah in a very particular way. Now, I want to talk to you just a little bit about the half sheet of paper that you have in front of you. This is a chiastic structure of Isaiah chapter 2, verse 1 through chapter 4, verse 6. Now, I've got it broken up. You see, this is the way scholars approach this. You see this in a lot of different proverbs, whatnot. It's a way of a Hebraic way of dealing with things. Let me show you what I mean. When you look at the first one, I should have done this on the paper, but it'd be the first one would be like an A. Okay? And the A here is God's kingdom will be established. Okay? Then you come underneath it, you know, the indented one would be B. B is condemnation of pride. That's chapter 2, verses 6 through 22. Then you have B again, which is the same basic thing being dealt with. Different words, different aspects of it, but nevertheless, it's still a condemnation of pride. And then you come back to A. God's kingdom will be established. You see that? That's how it's structured. And you will find that kind of structuring in a lot of places as you study the Bible. So you almost have two things that are alike. Sandwiched between them is two things that are alike. You see that? Everybody understand that? Okay, this is going to be a test now. Pay attention. Okay. And the reason why it's set up like that, it's not only a memory device, it's also an interpretive device. Where you find something like this. So that's you'll find that again in many places in the Bible. And normally you and I don't notice those because we're not thinking about it. This is not the same thing, but in the book of Mark does that. Not this, not this kind of chiastic structure, but what he does is he helps you interpret. You have Jesus sending out his disciples. You have the story of the martyrdom of John the Baptist. Then you have the return of the disciples. So even though it's not the same thing as this, it's similar in the respect that you have that interpretive device. What is Mark wanting us to know? Well, you're going to suffer if you follow the Lord, is what he's saying. That possibility exists. Secondly, though, Mark does it another way in the cursing of the fig tree. Okay? What you have, Jesus is hungry. He's heading into Jerusalem. There's a fig tree. It's fully leaved out. Sometimes there are green figs there. He goes. He looks for a green fig to eat. He's hungry. There's none. So he curses the fig tree. It looked like it was producing fruit, or could produce fruit, but it wasn't producing fruit, so he cursed it. Then he goes into Jerusalem, and what does he do? He cleanses the temple. And then the next day, they pass by again, and the fig tree is withered. So you have fig tree, in the middle, cleansing of the temple. You have Jesus is judging the temple. It looks like there's spiritual fruit from a distance. But when you get there, you discover it's not. It's barren. It's not producing any fruit at all. And just like he cursed the fig tree, he judges the temple. It's good to keep that in mind. There are those kind of interpretive devices. Mark just wants us to be sure to pay attention to those. Okay. So that's kind of the structure of the chapters we're going to be looking at tonight. This one and this one are the same. These two are going to be the same. Okay? So, do you need some encouragement tonight? I hope you do. Because even in the midst of this, or these chapters of God's judgment, don't miss these little oases of encouragement of what's coming. So, look at how chapter 2 begins. The vision of Isaiah, son of Amoz, He saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Okay? Now, what's the focus of this particular vision? Judah and Jerusalem. Okay? That is the focus. All right? And then it goes, in the last days. When? Last days. The mountain of the Lord, or the mountain of the Lord's house, will be established at the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. All nations will stream into it, and many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us about his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will settle disputes among the nations, and provide arbitration for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plows, and their spears into pruning knives. Nation will not take up sword against nation, and they will never train again for war. Now that's just those four verses. We get a glimpse of when is this going to be? In the last days. What's going to happen? Well, it's not only the reestablishment of Jerusalem, but you're going to have the nations. The nations want to go to Jerusalem. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. They want to go there. They want to, why do they want to go there? He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. There's going to be a hunger and a desire from among the nations. Who are the nations? That's all people groups other than the Jews. That those are the nations. We are part of that. There's going to be, and you know that we're not in the last days in this sense yet, because that is not what the nations want. They do not want to go up to the mountain of the Lord. They do not want to learn his ways and walk in his paths. And I want you to notice the result of all of this. They will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nation will not take up sword against nation, and they will never again train for war. Now, when is that going to be? Well, I would suggest to you, we're talking about the millennial reign of Christ, when this will take place. Because there's a good reason why the nations want to go up to the mountain of the Lord. Why? Because there's a king sitting there. And it's that king that the nations are going to come to. And that king is none other than the Lord himself, Lord Jesus himself. And that, well, the only time that can occur is going to be during the millennial reign. But then, of course, the focus shifts. That's the A. That future kingdom, the delights. Now we're going to go to the B's. B is the judgment upon our pride. House of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light, in the Lord's light. For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of divination from the east and from fortune tellers like the Philistines. They are in a league with foreigners. And he goes on down through there. But there is a particular statement, a word, that occurs 45 times in Isaiah. And it's a word that you're probably not going to readily pick up on yet. But we're going to see it's going to be mentioned several times. It's mentioned in chapter 2, verses 11, 12, 17, and 20. Chapter 3, verses 7 and 18. And in chapter 4, verse 1. What is that word? The word day. The word day. This is a very significant word for those 8th century prophets. Okay? Amos talks about it. Hosea talks about it. Other of the prophets, Zechariah who's not an 8th century prophet, but nevertheless, he talks about it. It's simply that day. And we've got to talk, we need to deal with that a little bit. That day. Well, what are we talking about? Well, when we talk about that day, the ancients perhaps, Jews particularly, especially in the days of Amos, which is just a little bit before Isaiah, Amos was. Amos basically says this, you think, and I'm paraphrasing here, loosely paraphrasing, you think that the day of the Lord is going to be a day of feasting. You think the day of blessing. It's going to be a day of cursing. It's a day of judgment, of wrath. One professor of mine from years ago described it this way. Amos is telling the people, you better get a big stick because you're going to have to fight God. And when we come across this, in most cases, not every case, but in most cases, when you start hearing this or reading this phrase, that on that day, you're talking about a day of God's judgment. And we need to bear in mind something very, very, it's really sobering to consider it. If God would judge His chosen people, Israel, because of their disobedience and their waywardness and their worship of false gods, do you think by any stretch of the imagination He would not also judge other countries that do the same, other nations? We need to be. It's sobering when you think about it. It's sobering when you think about it. I mentioned to you a book some time ago. It's called Eye to Eye. And the gentleman that wrote the book has, I mean, it's a massive book. He has chronicled at different times when the United States, he's focusing on the United States, when the United States, the government, however it might be couched in it, that those times where our nation, our leaders, somehow, some way pressure Israel to do something that they shouldn't do, that there is an event that happens right on the heels of that. What he's done is he's drawn the parallels. Okay? What he's done is he's brought them together. What was happening, I don't remember all of those. I think the book is in the library even, if you want to check it out. But just some of those events, like the bubble bursting in 2008, there was Bush administration was pressuring Israel to give up land. And just right after that particular thing, there was a major hurricane. Now, I haven't done the research, so I'm not trying to imply too much here. I will say this. And again, I'm going to be hesitant here, and don't take this as absolutely the fact, because I need to do more. I just haven't done it yet. I did hear a presidential candidate being asked the question, do you consider Netanyahu to be a close ally? She dodged the question and had something to do with, well, the Israeli people and the American people. And we've had two hurricanes. You do what you want to with that. And they're close together. And they're biggies. They're biggies. These are major deals. Katrina, there was an event that was just before that occurred. Listen, I know in evangelical Christianity, there's a lot of division about the place of Israel in God's plan. The nation of Israel is not a godly nation in the sense of following the commands of God. They're basically a secular nation. There's a lot of things that they do and allow that are not good. just right up front. But you need to realize something. Paul nails it. He says something that even the critics must be ignoring, those who want to divest from Israel and all that kind of thing. Because in Romans chapter 11, like verse 25 or something, it simply says this: the calling and the gifts of God are irrevocable. So Israel still, it's still, God's made promises to that, to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we better keep that in mind. They're a very small country. But you know, it's very impressive when Iran attacks that they have three different defense mechanisms taking down those missiles. That's just remarkable. Not necessarily trying to enter into the moral part of this question, but making pagers explode. And I think it was some radios explode. We're talking about incredible technology to be able to do those kind of things. Anyway, I don't want to go too far. But I want to go back to here. Even though God judges His people many times at different events, periods in history, they're still His people. And you're going to see from this, here when we're in B&B right now, we're in the judgment sections. But we're going to come back to the blessing again. Because He's not going to utterly destroy them. He's just not. He's going to discipline them, but He is not going to forsake them. Okay, so we go through this verse 11. The pride of mankind will be humbled, and human loftiness will be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted on that day. Keep that in mind. Verse 12. For a day belonging to the Lord is coming against all the proud and lofty, against all of that is lifted up. It will be humbled. And He's going to talk about a whole series of things here that I'll talk to. What is this day that the Lord's going to be exalted? What is this day that the proud will be brought down? It's this day of judgment. A day of God's wrath. Not simply a 24-hour period of history or time, but an event that's going to take place. That kind of day. When you look at verses 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, the majority of that, what you're going to discover in all of those, these are things that are talking about reference to idolatry, undoubtedly. These places where the false gods are worshipped. Where the Israelites of yesteryear, the Judeans of yesteryear, that where they were basically going to places of pagan worship. God's judging all of these. Verse 17, the pride of mankind will be brought low and human loftiness will be humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted on that day. You see the day again? The worthless idols will vanish completely. Will vanish completely. Verse 19. People will go into caves and rocks and holes in the ground away from thee. Now, I want you to notice word choices here. Away from the terror of the Lord and from His majestic splendor. When He rises to terrify the earth on that day, people will throw their worthless idols of silver and gold, which they have made to worship, to the moles and to the bats. And goes on down through there. More of that. You see, now you may hear some things kind of reminiscent of what you hear or have read in Revelation chapter 5. about those wanting the rocks and the mountains to cover them, to hide them from the face of the one who's coming. But I want you to notice things that you and I don't often think about. Terror. That his terror of the Lord and from his majestic splendor. When he rises to terrify the earth. Do you ever come across this kind of imagery about God? Paul says this, knowing the terror of the Lord, we persuade men, people. How often do we think about that? This is just a little critique of Christianity in general, myself in particular probably. We have lost, down through the ages, in our modern time, we really do not think properly about God. We think of Him in very tame terms. We think about Him as certain kind of attributes like love and mercy and grace and forgiveness and kindness. God would never do something like that. The problem that we're facing is we have either a very anemic view of God or a view of a God that does not exist. Because when Isaiah is uttering these words, Judah's doing pretty good. They're not in dire straits. They're not in hardship yet. There is something fearful happening. It's called the Assyrians. That's on the horizon. But thus far, the Assyrians are not coming this far south yet. They're going to, but not yet. So, you know, people, and they had their number of smiling prophets. They had those that were telling people what they wanted to hear. Oh, we're fine. The Lord has said that the Syrians will not come. The Lord has said He will deliver us. The Lord has said, you know, all these kind of false prophecies and false reassurances. That go away, you're fine. You're fine. Some might have even leaned on, well, we are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are God's special selected people. Because of that, we have a pass. Have you noticed how people do that? In the sense of, we probably all, to one measure or another, are guilty of this. We can excuse our own sin. We don't think it's that bad. Maybe somehow we have a special dispensation that God looks the other way with our particular sin. And we're okay with it. And that we don't think about it in the kind of terms that perhaps we should. We can play all kinds of games. But the words that impact me is this day is coming, but terror. Terror. I don't think that is very... I don't know if it even exists anymore in the lives of people. Christian people. There's no fear of God before their eyes. We can have people stand up and push legislation that is absolutely wicked and never once consider the repercussions of such a thing. No one's escaping. A God that knows all things... No one's going to escape. Well, let's go on further. I'm going to drop down into chapter 3. Chapter 3, we're still here. The pride. You see, pride is a very insidious sin. Because a proud person sees nothing to repent of. They just don't. So when you look at, even in the New Testament, you'll find one of the most wicked and most devastating of all sins is pride. Well, I thought it would be homosexuality. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's pride. It's pride. And it's so easy for us to slide into a posture where we think it's okay.
Let's go a little bit further in chapter 3. We'll pick up with verse 7. On that day, he will cry out saying, I am not a healer. I don't even have food or clothing in my house. Don't make me the leader of the people, for Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen because they have spoken and acted against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. The look on their faces testify against them, and like, now listen to this, and like Sodom, they flaunt their sin, and they do not conceal it.
I'm going to take you back to 1991. Living in Southeast Arkansas, I received a video in the mail from, I don't even know what group's in it. What it was, and this is back then, it was a gay pride parade. The word pride, Pride Month, all of those things, you see how those kind of keep cropping up? I never finished it. And a friend of mine, pastoring in a neighboring town, he took a hammer to his. And you have no idea. You have no idea. That was then, of how vile that was. And then there'd be parents along the way with children this size, watching, cheering. And today it's even worse. You don't have to go to a stand beside a street. You can go to a public library. And it'd be flaunted and rammed down your face or throat there. Anyway, what did Sodom do? They flaunted their sin. They did not even conceal it. That means the shame is gone. There's no shame that a person feels. They don't even hide it anymore. Which shows the depth of how bad things can become. We go a little bit further. We find these things. Look at down in verse 16. It says, the Lord also says, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, proudful again, walking with their heads held high and seductive eyes, prancing along, jingling their ankle bracelets, the Lord will put scabs on their heads. And the daughters of Zion and the Lord will shave their foreheads bare. On that day. You see, there's kind of a double usage of this phrase, on that day. There is the day that's coming, and it's going to be in 586 B.C. for Jerusalem. We're not there yet. We're still maybe 100 years away, but it's coming. There is that day that the Jews of yesteryear, it's in our past now. But what we're also seeing is something that would indicate what we would consider a double fulfillment in this respect. There is still, in the future, that day. These days of history are days of foreshadowing of what's coming. Okay? You follow? You'll find the double fulfillment of prophecy many times. Matter of fact, some of the prophecies about the coming of the Lord Jesus. You need to understand that there's a historical setting in which those prophecies were made that applied to the situation at hand, but there was a future fulfillment of it coming, a more complete one. So this was happening kind of as a preview, like when you go to the movies, you see a preview of coming attractions. That's kind of what we're talking about. So anyway, verse 18 again.
on that day, the Lord will strip their finery. Ankle bracelets, head crescents, pendants, bracelets, veils, head dresses, ankle jewelry, sashes, perfume bottles, amulets, signet rings, nose rings, festive robes, capes, cloaks, purses, garments, etc., turbans, shawls. Instead of perfume, there will be a stench. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of a beautifully styled hair, baldness. Instead of fine clothes, sackcloth. Instead of beauty, branding. Your men will fall by the sword, your warriors in battle, and her gates will lament and mourn. Deserted, she will sit on the ground. These are very, very stark words. And remember, things are going pretty good right now. And he's talking about this. He's talking about people that are conquered and humiliated and shamed. People who are living very luxuriously now, but will one day, they're not going to be living that way at all. They're going to be carried off. They're going to be overwhelmed, overcome. And those that survive are going to suffer. Yes?
That sounds a lot like Nazi Germany, too.
Yeah, it does. It does. The inhumane treatment of people by other people is not a rare thing. It's not rare at all. It's amazing how easily even a culture can slide into something like that. And matter of fact, next Wednesday night, you're going to see some examples of that. How did Hitler do what he did? We see some of the same methodology being used today. That's how. Yes.
What are the lists in 18 to 23? What do all those represent?
18 to 23. On that day, those are the clothing and the ornaments and the jewelry and those kind of things that many of the finer things that some of the ladies had in that day. Those kind of things.
I've got a note from ambulance that says objects to protect from evil.
Yeah.
So they were thinking they were okay and celebrating.
If we go back to chapter 1, we need to emphasize something. And this is what makes this particular indictment even more insidious in this respect. The worship of God was still occurring. But also the worship of pagan gods was happening. And later, I think it's even in Isaiah, later we'll get to the point where God will say, I will not share my glory with another. But it's exactly what the people were doing. We'll keep God happy. We'll keep God happy by we will offer sacrifices, we'll go to the temple, we'll do the perfunctory religious things, we'll do that. We'll observe some of the holy days. But that way God will be satisfied. And then we can also go after these other gods. And in doing that, they thought they could just get by with it. God's not going to allow that. In verse 1 of chapter 4, we're going to get that day again. On that day, seven women will seize one man, saying, "We will eat our own bread, we'll provide our own clothing. Just let us bear your name and take away our disgrace." Now, there's something being implied here. Why would or how would seven women attach themselves to one man, and in so doing, saying, "Hey, you don't have to, it's not going to cost you anything. We're going to provide everything for ourselves. Just let us be known by your name." And that was a very important thing of that day anyway. Okay. So, why do you think that is?
Get protection?
Yeah, well, yeah, some degree too.
What? Said,
where are the men? Yeah. You know where the men are? They're dead. That's where they are. They don't have. The other men are not available. They're gone. They're gone. Okay, so we're in here, the bees. Now let's go back to the A. Ready?
Yeah.
Anybody ready?
Yeah.
Please be ready, right? On that day, again, we're talking about that day. This day is not only a day of judgment, it is also a day of exaltation. On that day, the branch. Now, that is a very interesting word. On that day, the branch. Now, later we're going to see that again about the shoot from Jesse's stump and what that one is going to do. And it will be that far in the future that we'll be looking at there. There will be a branch. What's this branch going to do? The branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be a pride and a glory of Israel's survivors, the remnant. Whoever remains in Zion and whoever is left in Jerusalem will be called holy. All in Jerusalem, written in the book of life. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the blood guilt from the heart of Jerusalem by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create a cloud of smoke by day and a glowing flame of fire by night over the entire site of Mount Zion and over its assemblies. For there will be a canopy over all the glory, and there will be a great shelter from the shade of the heat of day, and a refuge and shelter from the storm and the rain. Okay. Again, you see that there is a, in the distance, looking through the judgment of God and the hardship that entails. But if you look into the future, there is, it's coming, it's there. And it's as if it's already started. It's that sure, as if you're living in it right now. It's not yet, but it's coming. And Isaiah has couched both of, in our time together tonight, he began with it and he ends with it. Judgment in the middle, but there's something to look forward to. Something to anticipate. Questions or observations anyone would like to offer?
Back up just a little bit. Back in chapter 3, verse 18. In my King James, the very last part of that sentence says, and I can't for the life of me understand what it's talking about. And it says, and their round tires like the moon.
That's verse 18?
Yeah. Chapter 3, verse 18.
Crescents, yeah.
So what? It says crescent necklace?
Yeah.
But it says round. Crescent is not round.
No, it says crescent.
Yeah.
Well, before that, mine it says bangles and headbands, too. So bangles are round.
Yeah. One of the things.
But did they know what tires were?
It's not tires like we think of tires.
I mean, I know they had wheels on their carts, but...
Yeah. One of the things sometimes we struggle with is that the meaning of words will change over time. And you know that. There are words that the meanings are you know, change a little bit. I remember being somewhat struggling, trying to understand 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning with verse 13 and following, when it says, you know, the Lord said, those who have fallen asleep, we will not prevent those who have fallen asleep. Talking about that, they're being resurrected there. How can you possibly prevent? I struggled with that word, trying to understand what it meant. As time went on, I discovered that the word during the translation period of the King James Version, the word prevent had a meaning that it lost over time. And it was the idea of preceding. We would not precede those who have fallen asleep. That was, in our day, that word precede had replaced the meaning of the word prevent. And there's even in the last 20 years, there are words that have somewhat changed in their meanings. And I've hinted to those. One is the difference between equality and equity. Mm-hmm. They sound a lot alike, don't they? But they're not. Mm-hmm. They're not. And then different other word usages too, that like tolerance, for example. Well, if you're my age, you understand what tolerance means. But if you're my daughter's age, they were taught the word tolerance means something different. Same word, but a different meaning. And sometimes you have to stop and ask, what exactly do you mean by tolerance? Don't assume you understand what they may mean by it. I think a lot of times when we talk to people, we get kind of sidetracked because we don't really, or they don't necessarily, understand what we mean by the use of a particular word. So tire is not a word that communicates well with us today. Not in that context. In that day, it made perfect sense. Made perfect sense. So, yes.
One word that I heard in an oldie song just the other day was gay, meaning happy.
Oh, yeah. That's a good example, too.
How gay we will be.
The word gay meant,
how happy we will be.
Yeah, if you went back into the 50s, gay was not a bad word. It was not a sexual word at all. It was you were happy. Mm-hmm. You were being happy. And see, so it's been co-opted too, and the meaning changed, and we don't even use it like happy anymore. Mm-hmm. So.
Be misunderstood.
Really. I want to leave you with this, though. Because there's going to be passages that we're going to be working our way through that are going to be heavy because of the indictment that God is making against His people through Isaiah the prophet. Having said that, there's also going to be these glimmers of what's coming. The prophets always did that. It wasn't they just felt like, I just want to beat them down and to make them feel lower than a snake's belly in a wagon rut. I just want to... They don't do that. They do pronounce God's judgment, that this wickedness is not going to escape God's notice, but they don't stop there. But just come back. This is all that He's got for you. This is what He desires for you. This is what He's going to bring. And there's those glimmers of what's coming. Next time, not next Wednesday night. Next Wednesday night we'll be doing that video. But the following Wednesday night, we'll be picking up with chapter 5. This is a very, 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 very important chapter because Jesus uses this imagery talking about the Song of the Vineyard. The Song of the Vineyard. You will recognize some of the imageries there, that images that are used that Jesus uses in some of His parables. It's an important one, by the way. Any other thoughts or yes?
Is that what you just talked about, in the harsh judgment followed by declarations of his love and care for his people. Often doesn't that have the same love before it? Doesn't that become kind of like this triad structure sometimes?
Sometimes.
It
doesn't always take this form like these chapters do, but it does. You will find that. You'll find those. I'll do it like this. We get to chapter 39. The warning is the Babylonians are coming. Hezekiah, you have blown it. They're coming. And then we get to chapter, that's 39. Get to chapter 40. This is how it begins. Comfort. Comfort my people. And we get to that second half of Isaiah. You're going to find messianic imagery over and over and over again. It's just phenomenal. You're going to see prophecy so specific that, you know, couple hundred years before a man takes place, before he's even born, his name is given. Cyrus. And we'll get to that too. We'll get to God revealing himself more of who he is through Isaiah's pen. There will be things that are often repeated. We're going to see in the latter chapters. It's going to be, I am the Lord, there is no other, there is no one like me. If you understand why we can't have graven images, there you go. There is nothing capable of representing an image representing who God is. There's nobody, nothing. There's no artist that's brilliant enough. There's nothing that exists. There is, I'm the Lord, there is no other. And there's no one like me. That's repeated at least three or four times. And so we'll get to those as well. All right. Pray for those in Florida. And for those that will be ministering to those who have already suffered because of these storms. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.